possibility of an Allied landing, this time between June 6th and June 16th. But there had been hundreds of these since April, and they were not taken seriously. Indeed, on the 6th, General Friedrich Dollmann, who commanded the 7th Army in Normandy, on whose beaches the Allied forces were about to land, ordered a temporary relaxation of the standing alert and convoked his senior officers for a map exercise at Rennes, some 125 miles south of those beaches. If the Germans were in the dark about the date of the invasion, they were also ignorant of where it would take place. Rundstedt and Rommel were certain it would be in the Pas-de-Calais area, where the channel was at its narrowest. There they had concentrated their strongest force, the 15th Army, whose strength during the spring was increased from 10 to 15 infantry divisions. But by the end of March, Adolf Hitler's uncanny intuition was telling him that the Schwerpunkt of the invasion probably would be in Normandy. And during the next few weeks he ordered considerable reinforcements to the region between the Seine and the Loire. "Watch Normandy," he kept warning his generals. Still, the overwhelming part of German strength, in both infantry and panzer divisions, was retained north of the Seine, between Le Havre and Dunkirk. Rundstedt and his generals were watching the Pas-de-Calais rather than Normandy, and they were encouraged in this by a number of deceptive maneuvers carried out during April and May by the British-American High Command, which indicated to them that their calculations were correct. The day of June 5th, then, passed in relative quiet, so far as the Germans were concerned. Severe Anglo-American air attacks continued to disrupt German depots, radar stations, V-1 sites, communications and transport, but these had been going on night and day for weeks and seemed no more intense on this day than on others. Shortly after dark, Rundstedt's headquarters was informed that the BBC in London was broadcasting an unusually large number of coded messages to the French resistance, and that the German radar stations between Cherbourg and Le Havre were being jammed. At 10 p.m., the 15th Army intercepted a code message from the BBC to the French resistance, which it believed meant that the invasion was about to begin. This army was alerted, but Rundstedt did not think it necessary to alert the 7th Army, on whose sector of the coast farther west, between Caen and Cherbourg, the Allied forces were now, toward midnight, approaching on 1,000 ships. It was not until 11 minutes past 1 a.m. June 6th that the 7th Army, its commander not yet returned from his map exercise at Rennes, realized what was happening. Two American and one British airborne divisions had begun landing in its midst. The general alarm was sounded at 1:30 a.m. 45 minutes later, Major General Max Pemsel, Chief of Staff of the 7th Army, got General Speidel on the telephone at Rommel's headquarters and told him that it looked like a large-scale operation. Speidel did not believe it, but passed on the report to Rundstedt, who was equally skeptical. Both generals believed the dropping of parachutists was merely an Allied feint to cover their main landings around Calais. At 2:40 a.m., Pemsel was advised that Rundstedt does not consider this to be a major operation. Not even when the news began to reach him shortly after dawn on June 6th that on the Normandy coast between the rivers Vire and Orne, a huge Allied fleet was disembarking large bodies of troops under cover of a murderous fire from the big guns of an armada of warships, did the commander-in-chief West believe that this was to be the main Allied assault. It did not become apparent, Speidel says, until the afternoon of June 6th. By that time, the Americans had a toehold on two beaches, and the British on a third, and had penetrated inland for a distance of from 2 to 6 miles. Speidel had telephoned Rommel at 6 a.m. at his home, and the field marshal had rushed back by car without going on to see Hitler, but he did not arrive at Army Group B headquarters until late that afternoon. Because of Allied air superiority in the West, Hitler had forbidden his senior commanders to travel by plane. In the meantime, Speidel, Rundstedt, and the latter's chief of staff, General Blumentritt, had been on the telephone to OKW, which was then at Berchtesgaden. Due to an idiotic order of Hitler's, not even the commander-in-chief in the West could employ his panzer divisions without the specific permission of the Führer. When the three generals, early on the morning of the 6th, begged for permission to rush two tank divisions to Normandy, Jodl replied that Hitler wanted first to see what developed, whereupon the Führer went to bed and could not be disturbed by the frantic calls of the generals in the West until 3 p.m. When he woke up, the bad news, which had in the meantime arrived, finally stirred the Nazi warlord to action. He gave, too late as it turned out, permission to engage the Panzerlehr and 12th SS Panzer Divisions in Normandy. He also issued a famous order which has been preserved for posterity in the log of the 7th Army. 16:55 hours, June 6, 1944. Chief of Staff Western Command emphasizes the desire of the Supreme Command to have the enemy in the bridgehead annihilated by the evening of June 6th, since there exists the danger of additional sea and airborne landings for support. The beachhead must be cleaned up by not later than tonight. In the eerie mountain air of the Obersalzberg, from which Hitler was now trying to direct the most crucial battle of the war up to this moment, he had been saying for months that Germany's destiny would be decided in the West, this fantastic order seems to have been issued in all seriousness, concurred in by Jodl and Keitel. Even Rommel, who passed it on by telephone shortly before 5 o'clock that afternoon, an hour after his return from Germany, seems to have taken it seriously, for he ordered 7th Army Headquarters to launch an attack by the 21st Panzer Division, the only German armored unit in the area, immediately, regardless of whether reinforcements arrive or not. This the division had already done, without waiting for Rommel's command. General Pemsel, who was on the other end of the line when Rommel called 7th Army Headquarters, gave a blunt reply to Hitler's demand that the Allied beachhead, there were actually now three, be cleaned up by not later than tonight. That, he replied, would be impossible. Hitler's much-propagandized Atlantic Wall had been breached within a few hours. The once vaunted Luftwaffe had been driven completely from the air, and the German navy from the sea, and the army taken by surprise. The battle was far from over, but its outcome was not long in doubt. From June 9th on, says Speidel, the initiative lay with the Allies. Rundstedt and Rommel decided that it was time to say so to Hitler, face to face, and to demand that he accept the consequences. They enticed him to a meeting on June 17th at Margival, north of Soissons, in the elaborate bomb-proof bunker which had been built to serve as the Führer's headquarters for the invasion of Britain in the summer of 1940, but never used. Now, 4 summers later, the Nazi warlord appeared there for the first time. He looked pale and sleepless, Speidel later wrote, playing nervously with his glasses and an array of colored pencils which he held between his fingers. He sat hunched upon a stool while the field marshals stood. His hypnotic powers seemed to have waned. There was a curt and frosty greeting from him. Then, in a loud voice, he spoke bitterly of his displeasure at the success of the Allied landings, for which he tried to hold the field commanders responsible. But the prospect of another stunning defeat was emboldening the generals, or at least Rommel, whom Rundstedt left to do most of the talking, when Hitler's diatribe against them had come to a momentary pause. With merciless frankness, says Speidel, who was present, Rommel pointed out that the struggle was hopeless against the Allied superiority in the air, at sea, and on the land. If, in spite of the enemy's air superiority, we succeed in getting a large part of our mobile force into action in the threatened coast defense sectors in the first hours, I am convinced that the enemy attack on the coast will collapse completely on its first day, Rommel had written General Jodl on April 23rd, less than 2 months before. The Rommel Papers, edited by Little Hart, page 468. Hitler's strict orders had made it impossible to throw in the armored divisions in the first hours or even the first days. When they finally arrived, they were thrown in piecemeal and failed. Well, not quite hopeless, if Hitler abandoned his absurd determination to hold every foot of ground and then to drive the Allied forces into the sea. Rommel proposed, with Rundstedt's assent, that the Germans withdraw out of range of the enemy's murderous naval guns, take their panzer units out of the line and reform them for a later thrust which might defeat the Allies in a battle fought outside the range of the enemy's naval artillery. But the Supreme Warlord would not listen to any proposal for withdrawal. German soldiers must stand and fight. The subject obviously was unpleasant to him, and he quickly changed to others. In a display which Speidel calls a strange mixture of cynicism and false intuition, Hitler assured the generals that the new V-1 weapon, the buzz bomb, which had been launched for the first time the day before against London, would be decisive against Great Britain and make the British willing to make peace. When the two field marshals drew Hitler's attention to the utter failure of the Luftwaffe in the West, the Führer retorted that Masses of jet fighters, the Allies had no jets but the Germans had just put them into production, would soon drive the British and American flyers from the skies. Then, he said, Britain would collapse. At this juncture, the approach of Allied planes forced them to adjourn to the Führer's air raid shelter. Safe in the underground concrete bunker, they resumed the conversation. The talks lasted from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., with a break for lunch, a one-dish meal, Speidel recounts, at which Hitler bolted a heaped plate of rice and vegetables after it had been previously tasted for him. Pills and liqueur glasses containing various medicines were ranged around his place, and he took them in turn. Two SS men stood guard behind his chair. And at this point, Rommel insisted on steering it into politics. He predicted, says Speidel, that the German front in Normandy would collapse and that a breakthrough into Germany by the Allies could not be checked. He doubted whether the Russian front could be held. He pointed to Germany's complete political isolation. He concluded with an urgent request that the war be brought to an end. Hitler, who had interrupted Rommel several times, finally cut him short. Don't you worry about the future course of the war, but rather about your own invasion front. The two field marshals were getting nowhere, either with their military or political arguments. Hitler paid no attention whatsoever to their warnings, General Jodl later recalled at Nuremberg. Finally, the generals urged the Supreme Commander at least to visit Rommel's Army Group B headquarters to confer with some of the field commanders on what they were up against in Normandy. Hitler reluctantly agreed to the visit for June 19th, 2 days hence. He never showed up. Shortly after the field marshals had departed from Marjival on the afternoon of June 17th, an errant V-1 on its way to London turned around and landed on top of the Führer's bunker. No one was killed or even hurt, but Hitler was so upset that he set off immediately for safer parts, not stopping until he got to the mountains of Berchtesgaden. There, more bad news shortly arrived. On June 20th, the long-awaited Russian offensive on the Central Front began, developing with such overwhelming power that within a few days the German Army Group Center, in which Hitler had concentrated his strongest forces, was completely smashed, the front torn wide open, and the road to Poland opened. On July 4th, the Russians crossed the 1939 Polish eastern border and converged on East Prussia. All available reserves of the High Command were quickly rounded up to be rushed, for the first time in World War II, to the defense of the Fatherland itself. This helped to doom the German armies in the West. From now on, they could not count on receiving any sizable reinforcements. Once more, on June 29th, Rundstedt and Rommel appealed to Hitler to face realities, both in the East and in the West, and to try to end the war while considerable parts of the German army were still in being. This meeting took place on the Obersalzberg, where the Supreme Warlord treated the two field marshals frostily, dismissing their appeals curtly and then lapsing into a long monologue on how he would win the war with new miracle weapons. His discourse, says Speidel, became lost in fantastic digressions. 2 days later, Rundstedt was replaced as Commander-in-Chief West by Field Marshal von Kluge. Rundstedt's dismissal may have come partly as the result of his blunt words to Keitel the night before. The latter had rung him up to inquire about the situation. An all-out German attack on the British lines by four SS panzer divisions had just floundered, and Rundstedt was in a gloomy mood. "What shall we do?" cried Keitel. "Make peace, you fools," Rundstedt retorted. "What else can you do?" It seems that Keitel, the tell-tale toady, as most army field commanders called him, went straight to Hitler with the remarks. The Führer was at that moment conferring with Kluge, who had been on sick leave for the last few months as the result of injuries sustained in a motor accident. Kluge was immediately named to replace Rundstedt. In such ways were top commands changed by the Nazi warlord. General Blumentritt told of the telephone conversation to both Wilmot, The Struggle for Europe, page 347, and Little Hart, The German General's Talk, page 205. On July 15th, Rommel wrote a long letter to Hitler and dispatched it by army teletype. "The troops," he wrote, "are fighting heroically everywhere, but the unequal struggle is nearing its end." He added a postscript in his own handwriting. "I must beg you to draw the proper conclusions without delay. I feel it my duty as Commander-in-Chief of the Army Group to state this clearly." "I have given him his last chance," Rommel told Speidel. "If he does not take it, we will act." 2 days later, on the afternoon of July 17th, while driving back to headquarters from the Normandy front, Rommel's staff car was shot up by low-flying Allied fighter planes, and he was so critically wounded that it was first thought he would not survive the day. This was a disaster to the conspirators, for Rommel had now, Speidel swears to it, made up his mind irrevocably to do his part in ridding Germany of Hitler's rule, though still opposing his assassination, within the next few days. As it turned out, his dash and daring were sorely missing among the army officers who, at long last, as the German armies crumbled in the east and west that July of 1944, made their final bid to bring Hitler and National Socialism down. The conspirators, says Speidel, felt themselves painfully deprived of their pillar of strength. Speidel quotes the writer Ernst Jünger, whose books had once been popular in Nazi Germany but who eventually had turned and had joined the Paris end of the plot. The blow that felled Rommel on the Livarot Road on July 17th deprived our plan of the only man strong enough to bear the terrible weight of war and civil war simultaneously. Speidel, Invasion 1944, page 119. The Conspiracy at the 11th Hour. The successful Allied landing in Normandy threw the conspirators in Berlin into great confusion. Stauffenberg, as we have seen, had not believed it would be attempted in 1944, and that if it were, there was a 50-50 chance that it would fail. He seems to have wished that it would, since then the American and British governments, after such a bloody and costly setback, would be more willing to negotiate a peace in the West with his new anti-Nazi government, which in this case could get better terms. When it became evident that the invasion had succeeded, that Germany had suffered another crucial defeat, and that a new one was threatening in the East, Stauffenberg, Beck, and Goerdeler wondered whether there was any point in going ahead with their plans. If they succeeded, they would only be blamed for bringing on the final catastrophe. Though they knew it was now inevitable, this was not generally realized by the mass of the German people. Beck finally concluded that though a successful anti-Nazi revolt could not now spare Germany from enemy occupation, it could bring the war to an end and save further loss of blood and destruction of the fatherland. A peace now would also prevent the Russians from overrunning Germany and Bolshevizing it. It would show the world that there was another Germany besides the Nazi one. And, who knew, perhaps at least the Western Allies, despite their terms of unconditional surrender, might not be too hard on a conquered Germany. Goerdeler agreed and pinned even greater hopes on the Western democracies. He knew, he said, how much Churchill feared the danger of a total Russian victory. The younger men, led by Stauffenberg, were not entirely convinced. They sought advice from Tresco, who was now chief of staff of the Second Army on the crumbling Russian front. His reply brought the stumbling plotters back on the track. The assassination must be attempted at any cost. Even should it fail, the attempt to seize power in the capital must be undertaken. We must prove to the world and to future generations that the men of the German resistance movement dared to take the decisive step and to hazard their lives upon it. Compared with this object, nothing else matters. This inspired answer settled the matter and revived the spirits and dissolved the doubts of Stauffenberg and his young friends. The threatened collapse of the fronts in Russia, France, and Italy impelled the plotters to act at once. Another event helped to speed them on their way. From the beginning, the Beck-Goerdeler-Hassel circle had declined to have anything to do with the communist underground, and vice versa. To the communists, the plotters were as reactionary as the Nazis, and their very success might prevent a communist Germany from succeeding a National Socialist one. Beck and his friends were well aware of this communist line, and they knew also that the communist underground was directed from Moscow and served chiefly as an espionage source for the Russians. Furthermore, they knew that it had become infiltrated with Gestapo agents. V-men, as Heinrich Müller, the Gestapo chief and himself a student and admirer of the Soviet NKVD, called them. This came out in the Rote Kapelle affair in 1942, when the Abwehr discovered a large number of strategically placed Germans, many of them from old prominent families, running an extensive espionage network for the Russians. At one time, they were transmitting intelligence to Moscow over some 100 clandestine radio transmitters in Germany and in the occupied countries of the West. The leader of the Rote Kapelle, Red Orchestra, was Harald Schulze-Boysen, the grandson of Grand Admiral von Tirpitz, a picturesque leader of the lost generation after the First World War, and a familiar bohemian figure in those days in Berlin, where his black sweater, his thick mane of blonde hair, and his passion for revolutionary poetry and politics attracted attention. At that time he rejected both Nazism and communism, though he considered himself a man of the left. Through his mother he got into the Luftwaffe as a lieutenant at the outbreak of the war and wormed himself into Goering's research office, the Forschungsamt, which, as we have seen in connection with the Anschluss, specialized in tapping telephones. Soon he was organizing a vast espionage service for Moscow, with trusted associates in every ministry and military office in Berlin. Among these were Arvid Harnack, nephew of a famous theologian, a brilliant young economist in the Ministry of Economics, who was married to an American woman, Mildred Fish, whom he had met at the University of Wisconsin, Franz Schellaha in the Foreign Office, Horst Heilmann in the Propaganda Ministry, and Countess Erika von Brockdorff in the Ministry of Labor. Two Soviet agents who parachuted into Germany and were later apprehended gave the Rote Kapelle away, and a large number of arrests followed. Of the 75 leaders charged with treason, 50 were condemned to death, including Schulze-Boysen and Harnack. Mildred Harnack and Countess von Brockdorff got off with prison sentences, but Hitler insisted that they be executed too, and they were. To impress would-be traitors, the Führer ordered that the condemned be hanged. But there were no gallows in Berlin, where the traditional form of execution was the axe, and so the victims were simply strangled by a rope around their necks, which was attached to a meat hook, borrowed from an abattoir, and slowly hoisted. From then on, this method of hanging was to be employed as a special form of cruelty on those who dared to defy the Führer. In June, the plotters, against the advice of Gerdler and the older members, decided to contact the communists. This was at the suggestion of the socialist wing, and especially of Adolf Reichwein, the socialist philosopher and celebrated Wandervogel, who was now director of the Folklore Museum in Berlin. Reichwein had maintained vague contacts with the communists. Though Stauffenberg himself was suspicious of them, his socialist friends, Reichwein and Labour, convinced him that some contact with them had become necessary in order to see what they were up to and what they would do in case the putsch succeeded, and if possible to use them at the last moment to widen the basis of the anti-Nazi resistance. Reluctantly, he agreed to Labour and Reichwein meeting with the underground communist leaders on June 22nd, but he warned them that the communists should be told as little as possible. The meeting took place in East Berlin between Labour and Reichwein, representing the socialists, and two individuals named Franz Jakob and Anton Sefko, who claimed to be, and perhaps were, the leaders of the communist underground. They were accompanied by a third comrade whom they introduced as Rambo. The communists turned out to know quite a bit about the plot against Hitler and wanted to know more. They asked for a meeting with its military leaders on July 4th. Stauffenberg refused, but Reichwein was authorized to represent him at a further meeting on that date. When he arrived at it, he, along with Jakob and Sefko, were promptly arrested. Rambo, it turned out, was a Gestapo stool pigeon. The next day, Labour, on whom Stauffenberg was counting to become the dominant political force in the new government, was also arrested. All four, Labour, Reichwein, Jakob, and Sefko, were executed. Stauffenberg was not only deeply upset by the arrest of Labour, with whom he had become a close personal friend and whom he regarded as indispensable to the proposed new government, but he saw at once that the whole conspiracy was in dire peril of being snuffed out now that Himmler's men were so close on its trail. Labour and Reichwein were courageous men and could be counted on, he thought, not to reveal any secrets, even under torture. Or could they be? Some of the plotters were not so sure. There might be limits beyond which even the bravest man could not keep silent when his body was being racked by insufferable pain. The arrest of Labour and Reichwein was a further spur to immediate action. The coup of July 20, 1944. Toward the end of June, the plotters received one good stroke of fortune. Stauffenberg was promoted to full colonel and appointed chief of staff to General Fromm, the commander-in-chief of the Home Army. This post not only enabled him to issue orders to the Home Army under Fromm's name, but gave him direct and frequent access to Hitler. Indeed, the Führer began to summon the chief of the replacement army, or his deputy, to headquarters 2 or 3 times a week to demand fresh replacements for his decimated divisions in Russia. At one of these meetings, Stauffenberg intended to plant his bomb. Stauffenberg had now become the key man in the conspiracy. On his shoulders alone rested its only chance for success. As the one member of the plot who could penetrate the heavily guarded Führer headquarters, it was up to him to kill Hitler. As chief of staff of the replacement army, it would have to be left to him, since Fromm had not been won over completely and could not be definitely counted on, to direct the troops that were to seize Berlin after Hitler was out of the way. And he had to carry out both objectives on the same day and at 2 spots separated by 200 or 300 miles. The Führer's headquarters, whether on the Obersalzberg or at Rostenburg, and Berlin. Between the first and the second acts, there must be an interval of 2 or 3 hours while his plane was droning back to the capital, during which he could do nothing but hope that his plans were being energetically initiated by his confederates in Berlin. That was one trouble, as we shall shortly see. There were others. One seems to have been an almost unnecessary complication that sprang up in the minds of the now desperate conspirators. They came to the conclusion that it would not suffice to kill Adolf Hitler. They must at the same time kill Göring and Himmler, thus ensuring that the military forces under the command of these two men could not be used against them. They thought, too, that the top generals at the front who had not yet been won over would join them more quickly if Hitler's 2 chief lieutenants were also done away with. Since Göring and Himmler usually attended the daily military conferences at the Führer headquarters, it was believed that it would not be too difficult to kill all 3 men with 1 bomb. This foolish resolve led Stauffenberg to miss 2 golden opportunities. He was summoned to the Obersalzberg on July 11th to report to the Führer on the supply of badly needed replacements. He carried with him on the plane down to Berchtesgaden one of the Abwehr's English-made bombs. It had been decided at a meeting of the plotters in Berlin the night before that this was the moment to kill Hitler, and Göring and Himmler as well. But Himmler was not present at the conference that day, and when Stauffenberg, leaving the meeting for a moment, rang up General Olbricht in Berlin to tell him so, stressing that he could still get Hitler and Göring, the general urged him to wait for another day when he could get all 3. That night, on his return to Berlin, Stauffenberg met with Beck and Olbricht and insisted that the next time he must attempt to kill Hitler, regardless of whether Göring and Himmler were present or not. The others agreed. The next time was soon at hand. On July 14th, Stauffenberg was ordered to report the next day to the Führer on the replacement situation. Every available recruit was needed to help fill the gaps in Russia, where Army Group Center, having lost 27 divisions, had ceased to exist as a fighting force. That day, the 14th, Hitler had moved his headquarters back to Wolfschanze at Rostenburg to take personal charge of trying to restore the Central Front, where Red Army troops had now reached a point but 60 miles from East Prussia. Again, on the morning of July 15th, Colonel Stauffenberg set out by plane for the Führer's headquarters with a bomb in his briefcase. There is disagreement among the historians whether Stauffenberg set out for Rostenburg or the Obersalzberg. The 2 most authoritative German writers on the subject, Eberhard Zeller and Professor Gerhard Ritter, give contradictory accounts. Zeller thinks Hitler was still at Berchtesgaden, but Ritter is sure this is a mistake and that the Führer had returned to Rostenburg. Unfortunately, Hitler's daily calendar book, which has proved an unfailing guide to this writer up to this point, was not captured intact and does not cover this period. But the best evidence, including a report on Stauffenberg's movements drawn up at Führer headquarters on July 22nd, indicates pretty conclusively that on July 15th, Hitler was at Rostenburg and that it was there that Stauffenberg planned to kill him. Though the 2 places from which Hitler tried to conduct the war, he was rarely in Berlin, which was being unmercifully bombed, were about equidistant from the capital, Berchtesgaden, being more centrally located and near Munich, where the army garrison was believed to be loyal to Beck, had certain advantages over Rostenburg for the conspirators. This time the conspirators were so certain of success that it was agreed that the first Valkyrie signal, for the troops to start marching in Berlin and for the tanks from the Panzer School at Kramtnitz to begin rolling toward the capital, should be given 2 hours before Hitler's conference, scheduled for 1 p.m., began. There must be no delay in taking over. At 11 a.m. on Saturday, July 15th, General Olbricht issued Valkyrie 1 for Berlin, and before noon troops were moving toward the center of the capital, with orders to occupy the Wilhelmstrasse quarter. At 1 p.m., Stauffenberg, briefcase in hand, arrived at the Führer's conference room, made his report on replacements, and then absented himself long enough to telephone Olbricht in Berlin to say, by prearranged code, that Hitler was present and that he intended to return to the meeting and set off his bomb. Olbricht informed him that the troops in Berlin were already on the march. At last, success in the great enterprise seemed at hand. But when Stauffenberg returned to the conference room, Hitler had left it and did not return. Disconsolate, Stauffenberg hurriedly rang up Olbricht with the news. The general frantically canceled the Valkyrie alarm, and the troops were marched back to their barracks as quickly and as inconspicuously as possible. The news of still another failure was a heavy blow to the conspirators, who gathered in Berlin on Stauffenberg's return to consider what next to do. Goerdeler was for resorting to the so-called Western solution. He proposed to Beck that both of them fly to Paris to confer with Field Marshal von Kluge on getting an armistice in the West, whereby the Western Allies would agree not to push farther than the Franco-German border, thus releasing the German armies in the West to be shunted to the Eastern Front to save the Reich from the Russians and their Bolshevism. Beck had a clearer head. The idea that they could now get a separate peace with the West, he knew, was a pipe dream. Nevertheless, the plot to kill Hitler and overthrow Nazism must be carried out at all costs, Beck argued, if only to save Germany's honor. Stauffenberg agreed. He swore he would not fail the next time. General Olbricht, who had received a dressing down from Keitel for moving his troops in Berlin, declared that he could not risk doing it again, since that would unmask the whole conspiracy. He had barely got by, he said, with an explanation to Keitel and Fromm that this was a practice exercise. This fear of again setting the troops in motion until it was known definitely that Hitler was dead was to have disastrous consequences on the crucial following Thursday. On Sunday evening, July 16th, Stauffenberg invited to his home at Wannsee a small circle of his close friends and relatives. His brother, Berthold, a quiet, introspective, scholarly young man who was an advisor on international law at naval headquarters, Lieutenant Colonel Kaiser von Hofacker, a cousin of the Stauffenbergs and their liaison man with the generals in the West, Count Fritz von der Schulenburg, a former Nazi who was still deputy police president of Berlin, and Trotz zu Solz. Hofacker had just returned from the West, where he had conferred with a number of generals, Falkenhausen, Stulpnagel, Speidel, Rommel, and Kluge. He reported an imminent German breakdown on the Western Front, but, more important, that Rommel would back the conspiracy regardless of which way Kluge jumped, though he still opposed killing Hitler. After a long discussion, the young conspirators agreed, however, that ending Hitler's life was now the only way out. They had no illusions by this time that their desperate act would save Germany from having to surrender unconditionally. They even agreed that this would have to be done to the Russians as well as to the Western democracies. The important thing, they said, was for Germans, and not their foreign conquerors, to free Germany from Hitler's tyranny. They were terribly late. The Nazi despotism had endured for 11 years, and only the certainty of utter defeat in a war which Germany had launched, and which they had done little to oppose, or in many cases not opposed at all, had roused them to action. But better late than never. There remained, however, little time. The generals at the front were advising them that collapse in both the East and the West was probably only a matter of weeks. For the plotters, there seemed to be only a few more days left to them to act. The premature march of the troops in Berlin on July 15th had aroused the suspicions of OKW. On that day came news that General von Falkenhausen, one of the leaders of the plot in the West, had been suddenly dismissed from his post as military governor of Belgium and northern France. Someone, it was feared, must be giving them away. On July 17th, they learned that Rommel had been so seriously wounded that he would have to be left out of their plans indefinitely. The next day, Goerdeler was tipped off by his friends at police headquarters that Himmler had issued an order for his arrest. At Stauffenberg's insistence, Goerdeler went, protesting, into hiding. That same day, a personal friend in the Navy, Captain Alfred Kranzfelder, one of the very few naval officers in on the conspiracy, informed Stauffenberg that rumors were spreading in Berlin that the Führer's headquarters were to be blown up in the next few days. Again, it seemed that someone in the conspiracy must have been indiscreet. Everything pointed to the Gestapo's closing in on the inner ring of the conspiracy. On the afternoon of July 19th, Stauffenberg was again summoned to Rastenburg to report to Hitler on the progress being made with the new Volksgrenadier divisions, which the replacement army was hurriedly training to be thrown in on the dissolving Eastern Front. He was to make his report at the first daily conference at Führer headquarters the next day, July 20th, at 1 p.m. General Adolf Heusinger, chief of operations of the Army High Command, recounts that on July 19th, the news from the Ukrainian front was so bad that he inquired at OKW whether the replacement army had any troops in training in Poland which might be thrown into the Eastern Front. Keitel suggested that Stauffenberg be summoned the next day to advise them. Heusinger, Befehl im Widerstreit, page 350. Field Marshal von Witzleben and General Hoeppner, who lived some distance outside Berlin, were notified by Stauffenberg to appear in the city in good time. General Beck made his last-minute preparations for directing the coup until Stauffenberg could return by air from his murderous deed. The key officers in the garrisons in and around Berlin were apprised that July 20th would be der Tag. Stauffenberg worked at the Bendlerstrasse on his report for Hitler until dusk, leaving his office shortly after 8 o'clock for his home at Wannsee. On his way, he stopped off at a Catholic church in Dahlem to pray. Fitzgibbon says, 20 July, page 150, it is believed that he had previously confessed, but of course could not be granted absolution. The author recounts that Stauffenberg had told the Bishop of Berlin, Cardinal Count Preising, of what he intended to do, and that the bishop had replied that he honored the young man's motives and did not feel justified in attempting to restrain him on theological grounds. Heusinger, Befehl im Widerstreit, page 152. He spent the evening at home quietly with his brother, Berthold, and retired early. Everyone who saw him that afternoon and evening remembered that he was amiable and calm, as if nothing unusual was in the offing. July 20th, 1944. Shortly after 6 o'clock on the warm, sunny summer morning of July 20th, 1944, Colonel Stauffenberg, accompanied by his adjutant, Lieutenant Werner von Heften, drove out past the bombed-out buildings of Berlin to the airport at Rangsdorf. In his bulging briefcase were papers concerning the new Volksgrenadier divisions on which at 1 p.m. he was to report to Hitler at the Wolf's Lair at Rastenburg in East Prussia. In between the papers, wrapped in a shirt, was a time bomb. It was identical to the one which Tresco and Schlabrendorf had planted in the Führer's airplane the year before and which had failed to explode. Of English make, as we have seen, it was set off by breaking a glass capsule, whose acid then ate away a small wire, which released the firing pin against the percussion cap. The thickness of the wire governed the time required to set off the explosion. On this morning, the bomb was fitted with the thinnest possible wire. It would dissolve in a bare 10 minutes. At the airport, Stauffenberg met General Stief, who had produced the bomb the night before. There they found a plane waiting, the personal craft of General Edvard Wagner, the first quartermaster general of the army, and a ringleader in the plot, who had arranged to put it at their disposal for this all-important flight. By 7 o'clock, the plane was off, landing at Rastenburg shortly after 10 a.m. Heften instructed the pilot to be ready to take off for the return trip at any time after 12 noon. From the airfield, a staff car drove the party to the Volksschanze headquarters, set in a gloomy, damp, heavily wooded area of East Prussia. It was not an easy place to get into, or, as Stauffenberg undoubtedly noted, out of. It was built in three rings, each protected by minefields, pillboxes, and an electrified barbed wire fence, and was patrolled day and night by fanatical SS troops. To get into the heavily guarded inner compound where Hitler lived and worked, even the highest general had to have a special pass, good for one visit, and pass the personal inspection of SS Oberführer Rottentuber, Himmler's chief of security and commander of the SS Guard, or of one of his deputies. However, since Hitler himself had ordered Stauffenberg to report, he and Heften, though they were stopped and their passes examined, had little trouble in getting through the three checkpoints. After breakfast with Captain von Mühlendorf, adjutant to the camp commander, Stauffenberg sought out General Fritz Feldgiebel, chief of signals at OKW. Feldgiebel was one of the key men in the plot. Stauffenberg made sure that the general was ready to flash the news of the bombing to the conspirators in Berlin, so that action there could begin immediately. Feldgebel was then to isolate the Führer headquarters by shutting off all telephone, telegraph, and radio communications. No one was in such a perfect position to do this as the head of the OKW communications network, and the plotters counted themselves lucky to have won him over. He was indispensable to the success of the entire conspiracy. After calling on General Bühler, the army's representative at OKW, to discuss the affairs of the replacement army, Stauffenberg walked over to Keitel's quarters, hung up his cap and belt in the anteroom, and entered the office of the chief of OKW. There he learned that he would have to act with more dispatch than he had planned. It was now a little after 12 noon, and Keitel informed him that because Mussolini would be arriving by train at 2:30 p.m., the Führer's first daily conference had been put forward from 1 p.m. to 12:30. The colonel, Keitel advised, must make his report brief. Hitler wanted the meeting over early. Before the bomb could go off? Stauffenberg must have wondered if once again, and on what was perhaps his last try, fate was robbing him of success. Apparently he had hoped, too, that this time the conference with Hitler would be held in the Führer's underground bunker, where the blast from the bomb would be several times more effective than in one of the surface buildings. But Keitel told him the meeting would be in the Lagerbarracke, the conference barracks. This was far from being the flimsy wooden hut so often described. During the previous winter, Hitler had had the original wooden structure reinforced with concrete walls 18 inches thick to give protection against incendiary and splinter aerial bombs that might fall nearby. These heavy walls would add force to Stauffenberg's bomb. A number of writers have declared that Hitler's daily military conferences at Rastenburg usually took place in his underground bunker, and that because of repairs being made to it and because of the hot, humid day, the meeting on July 20th was shifted to the building above ground. This accidental change of place saved Hitler's life, Bullock writes, Hitler, page 681. It is to be doubted if there was any accidental change of place. The Lagerbarracke, as its name implies, was, so far as I can make out, the place where the daily conferences were usually held. Only in case of threatened air raids were the meetings adjourned to the underground bunker, which, at that, would have been cooler on this sweltering day. See Zeller, Geist der Freiheit, page 360, note 4. Stauffenberg must soon set the bomb to working. He had briefed Keitel on what he proposed to report to Hitler, and toward the end had noticed the OKW chief glancing impatiently at his watch. A few minutes before 12:30, Keitel said they must leave for the conference immediately or they would be late. They emerged from his quarters, but before they had taken more than a few steps, Stauffenberg remarked that he had left his cap and belt in the anteroom, and quickly turned to go back for them before Keitel could suggest that his adjutant, Lieutenant von Jon, who was walking alongside, should retrieve them for him. In the anteroom, Stauffenberg swiftly opened his briefcase, seized the tongs with the only 3 fingers he had, and broke the capsule. In just 10 minutes, unless there was another mechanical failure, the bomb would explode. Keitel, as much a bully with his subordinates as he was a toady with his superiors, was aggravated at the delay and turned back to the building to shout to Stauffenberg to get a move on. They were late, he yelled. Stauffenberg apologized for the delay. Keitel no doubt realized that it took a man as maimed as the colonel a little extra time to put on his belt. As they walked over to Hitler's hut, Stauffenberg seemed to be in a genial mood, and Keitel's petty annoyance, he had no trace of suspicion as yet, was dissipated. Nevertheless, as Keitel had feared, they were late. The conference had already begun. As Keitel and Stauffenberg entered the building, the latter paused for a moment in the entrance hall to tell the sergeant major in charge of the telephone board that he expected an urgent call from his office in Berlin, that it would contain information he needed to bring his report up to the minute, this was for Keitel's ear, and that he was to be summoned immediately when the call came. This, too, though it must have seemed most unusual, even a field marshal would scarcely dare to leave the Nazi warlord's presence until he had been dismissed, or until the conference was over and the supreme commander had left first, did not arouse Keitel's suspicions. The two men entered the conference room. About 4 minutes had ticked by since Stauffenberg reached into his briefcase with his tongs and broke the capsule. 6 minutes to go. The room was relatively small, some 30 by 15 feet, and it had 10 windows, all of which were wide open to catch the breezes on this hot, sultry day. So many open windows would certainly reduce the effect of any bomb blast. In the middle of the room was an oblong table, 18 by 5 feet, made of thick oak planks. It was a peculiarly constructed table in that it stood not on legs, but on 2 large heavy supports, or socles, placed near the ends and extending to nearly the width of the table. This interesting construction was not without its effect on subsequent history. When Stauffenberg entered the room, Hitler was seated at the center of the long side of the table, his back to the door. On his immediate right were General Heusinger, Chief of Operations and Deputy Chief of Staff of the Army, General Korten, Air Force Chief of Staff, and Colonel Heinz Brandt, Heusinger's Chief of Staff. Keitel took his place immediately to the left of the Führer, and next to him was General Jodl. There were 18 other officers of the 3 services and the SS standing around the table, but Goering and Himmler were not among them. Only Hitler, playing with his magnifying glass, which he now needed to read the fine print on the maps spread before him, and 2 stenographers were seated. Heusinger was in the midst of a lugubrious report on the latest breakthrough on the Central Russian front and on the perilous position as a consequence of the German armies not only there but on the northern and southern fronts as well. Keitel broke in to announce the presence of Colonel von Stauffenberg and its purpose. Hitler glanced up at the one-armed colonel with a patch over one eye, greeted him curtly, and announced that before hearing his report he wanted to have done with Heusinger's. Stauffenberg thereupon took his place at the table between Korten and Brandt, a few feet to the right of Hitler. He put his briefcase on the floor, shoving it under the table so that it leaned against the inside of the stout oaken support. It was about 6 feet distant from the Führer's legs. The time was now 12:37, 5 minutes to go. Heusinger continued to talk, pointing constantly to the situation map spread on the table. Hitler and the officers kept bending over to study it. No one seems to have noticed Stauffenberg stealing away, except perhaps Colonel Brandt. This officer became so absorbed in what his general was saying that he leaned over the table the better to see the map, discovered that Stauffenberg's bulging briefcase was in his way, tried to shove it aside with his foot, and finally reached down with one hand and lifted it to the far side of the heavy table support, which now stood between the bomb and Hitler. According to the account given Allied interrogators by Admiral Kurt Ostmann, who was present, Stauffenberg had whispered to Brandt, "I must go and telephone. Keep an eye on my briefcase. It has secret papers in it." This seemingly insignificant gesture probably saved the Führer's life. It cost Brandt his. There was an inexplicable fate involved here. Colonel Brandt, it will be remembered, was the innocent officer whom Tresco had induced to carry a couple of bottles of brandy back on Hitler's plane from Smolensk to Rostenburg on the evening of March 13, 1943. And he had done so without the faintest suspicion that they were in reality a bomb, the very make of bomb which he had now unostentatiously moved farther away under the table from the warlord. Its chemical had by this time almost completed the eating away of the wire that held back the firing pin. Keitel, who was responsible for the summoning of Stauffenberg, glanced down the table to where the colonel was supposed to be standing. Heusinger was coming to the end of his gloomy report, and the OKW chief wanted to indicate to Stauffenberg that he should make ready to report next. Perhaps he would need some aid in getting his papers out of his briefcase. But the young colonel, he saw to his extreme annoyance, was not there. Recalling what Stauffenberg had told the telephone operator on coming in, Keitel slipped out of the room to retrieve this curiously behaving young officer. Stauffenberg was not at the telephone. The sergeant at the board said he had hurriedly left the building. Nonplussed, Keitel turned back to the conference room. Heusinger was concluding, at last, his report on the day's catastrophic situation. "The Russian," he was saying, "is driving with strong forces west of the Duna toward the north. His spearheads are already southwest of Dunaburg. If our army group around Lake Peipus is not immediately withdrawn, a catastrophe—" It was a sentence that was never finished. At that precise moment, 12:42 p.m., the bomb went off. Stauffenberg saw what followed. He was standing with General Feldgebel, before the latter's office in Bunker 88, a couple of hundred yards away, glancing anxiously first at his wristwatch as the seconds ticked off, and then at the conference barracks. He saw it go up with a roar in smoke and flame, as if, he said later, it had been hit directly by a 155-millimeter shell. Bodies came hurtling out of the windows. Debris flew into the air. There was not the slightest doubt in Stauffenberg's excited mind that every single person in the conference room was dead or dying. He bade a hasty farewell to Feldgiebel, who was now to telephone the conspirators in Berlin that the attempt had succeeded, and then cut off communications until the plotters in the capital had taken over the city and proclaimed the new government. A good many writers have contended that at this moment General Feldgiebel was to have blown up the communications center, and that his failure to do so was disastrous to the conspiracy. Thus Wheeler Bennett, Nemesis, page 643, writes that General Feldgiebel failed lamentably in the execution of his task. Since the various communications centers were housed in several different underground bunkers, heavily guarded by SS, it is most improbable that Stauffenberg's plans ever called for blowing them up, an impossible task for the general. What Feldgiebel agreed to do was to shut off communication with the outside world for 2 or 3 hours after he had sent word to Berlin of the explosion. This, except for an unavoidable lapse or two, he did. Stauffenberg's next task was to get out of the Rostenburg headquarters camp alive and quickly. The guards at the checkpoints had seen or heard the explosion at the Führer's conference hall and immediately closed all exits. At the first barrier, a few yards from Feldgiebel's bunker, Stauffenberg's car was halted. He leaped out and demanded to speak with the duty officer in the guardroom. In the latter's presence, he telephoned someone, whom is not known, spoke briefly, hung up, and turned to the officer, saying, "Herr Leutnant, I am allowed to pass." This was pure bluff, but it worked, and apparently, after the lieutenant had dutifully noted in his log, 12:44, Colonel Stauffenberg passed through, word was sent along to the next checkpoint to let the car through. At the third and final barrier, it was more difficult. Here, an alarm had already been received, the rail had been lowered and the guard doubled, and no one was to be permitted to enter or leave. Stauffenberg and his aide, Lieutenant Heften, found their car blocked by a very stubborn sergeant major named Kolbe. Again, Stauffenberg demanded the use of the telephone and rang up Captain von Mühlendorf, adjutant to the camp commander. He complained that because of the explosion, the guard would not let him through. "I'm in a hurry. General Fromm is waiting for me at the airfield." This also was bluff. Fromm was in Berlin, as Stauffenberg well knew. Hanging up, the colonel turned to the sergeant. "You heard, Sergeant. I'm allowed through." But the sergeant was not to be bluffed. He himself rang through to Mühlendorf for confirmation. The captain gave it. The car then raced to the airport while Lieutenant Heften hurriedly dismantled a second bomb that he had brought along in his briefcase, tossing out the parts on the side of the road where they were later found by the Gestapo. The airfield commandant had not yet received any alarm. The pilot had his engines warming up when the two men drove onto the field. Within a minute or two, the plane took off. It was now shortly after 1 p.m. The next 3 hours must have seemed the longest in Stauffenberg's life. There was nothing he could do as the slow Heinkel plane headed west over the sandy flat German plain but to hope that Feldgiebel had been able to get through to Berlin with the all-important signal, that his fellow plotters in the capital had swung immediately into action in taking over the city and sending out the prepared messages to the military commanders in Germany and in the West, and that his plane would not be forced down by alerted Luftwaffe fighters or by prowling Russian craft, which were increasingly active over East Prussia. His own plane had no long-distance radio which might have enabled him to tune in on Berlin and hear the first thrilling broadcasts which he expected the conspirators would be making before he landed. Nor, for this lack, could he himself communicate with his confederates in the capital and give the signal that General Feldgiebel might not have been able to flash. His plane droned on through the early summer afternoon. It landed at Rangsdorf at 3:45 p.m., and Stauffenberg, in high spirits, raced to the nearest telephone at the airfield to put through a call to General Olbricht to learn exactly what had been accomplished in the fateful 3 hours on which all depended. To his utter consternation, he found that nothing had been accomplished. Word about the explosion had come through by telephone from Feldgiebel shortly after 1 o'clock, but the connection was bad, and it was not quite clear to the conspirators whether Hitler had been killed or not. Therefore, nothing had been done. The Valkyrie orders had been taken from Olbricht's safe, but not sent out. Everyone in the Bendlerstrasse had been standing idly by, waiting for Stauffenberg's return. General Beck and Field Marshal von Witzleben, who was the new head of state and commander-in-chief of the Wehrmacht, respectively, were supposed to have started issuing immediately the already prepared proclamations and commands, and to have gone on the air at once to broadcast the dawn of a new day in Germany, had not yet showed up. Hitler, contrary to Stauffenberg's firm belief, which he imparted to Olbricht on the telephone from Rangsdorf, had not been killed. Colonel Brandt's almost unconscious act of shoving the briefcase to the far side of the stout oaken table support had saved his life. He had been badly shaken, but not severely injured. His hair had been singed, his legs burned, his right arm bruised and temporarily paralyzed, his eardrums punctured, and his back lacerated by a falling beam. He was, as one eyewitness later recalled, hardly recognizable as he emerged from the wrecked and burning building on the arm of Keitel, his face blackened, his hair smoking, and his trousers in shreds. Keitel, miraculously, was uninjured. But most of those who had been at the end of the table where the bomb had exploded were either dead, dying, or badly wounded. The official stenographer, Berger, was killed, and Colonel Brandt, General Schmundt, Hitler's adjutant, and General Korten died of their wounds. All the others, including Generals Jodl, Bodenschatz, Goering's chief of staff, and Huizinger, were more or less severely injured. In the first excitement, there were several guesses as to the origin of the explosion. Hitler thought at first it might have been caused by a sneak attack of an enemy fighter-bomber. Jodl, nursing a blood-spattered head, the chandelier, among other objects, had fallen on him, was convinced that some of the building laborers had planted a time bomb under the floor of the building. The deep hole which Stauffenberg's bomb had blown in the floor seemed to confirm this. It was some time before the colonel became suspected. Himmler, who came running to the scene on hearing the explosion, was completely puzzled, and his first act was to telephone, a minute or two before Feldgebel shut down communications, Arthur Nebe, the head of the criminal police in Berlin, to dispatch by plane a squad of detectives to carry out the investigation. In the confusion and shock, no one at first remembered that Stauffenberg had slipped out of the conference room shortly before the explosion. It was at first believed that he must have been in the building and was one of those severely hurt who had been rushed to the hospital. Hitler, not yet suspicious of him, asked that the hospital be checked. Some 2 hours after the bomb went off, the clues began to come in. The sergeant who operated the telephone board at the Lagerbaracke reported that the one-eyed colonel, who had informed him he was expecting a long-distance call from Berlin, had come out of the conference room and, without waiting for it, had left the building in a great hurry. Some of the participants at the conference recalled that Stauffenberg had left his briefcase under the table. The guardhouses at the checkpoints revealed that Stauffenberg and his aide had passed through immediately after the explosion. Hitler's suspicions were now kindled. A call to the airfield at Rostenburg supplied the interesting information that Stauffenberg had taken off from there in great haste shortly after 1 p.m., giving as his destination the airport at Rangsdorf. Himmler immediately ordered that he be arrested on landing there, but his order never got through to Berlin because of Feldgebel's courageous action in closing down communications. Up to this minute, no one at headquarters seems to have suspected that anything untoward might be happening in Berlin. All now believed that Stauffenberg had acted alone. It would not be difficult to apprehend him unless, as some suspected, he had landed behind the Russian lines. Hitler, who, under the circumstances, seems to have behaved calmly enough, had something else on his mind. He had to greet Mussolini, who was due to arrive at 4 p.m., his train having been delayed. There is something weird and grotesque about this last meeting of the two fascist dictators on the afternoon of July 20, 1944, as they surveyed the ruins of the conference hall and tried to fool themselves into thinking that the axis which they had forged, and which was to have dominated the continent of Europe, was not also in shambles. The once proud and strutting Duce was now no more than a Gauleiter of Lombardy, rescued from imprisonment by Nazi thugs and propped up by Hitler and the SS. Yet the Führer's friendship and esteem for the fallen Italian tyrant had never faltered, and and he greeted him with as much warmth as his physical condition permitted, showed him through the still-smoking debris of the Laga Baraka, where his life had almost been snuffed out a few hours before, and predicted that their joint cause would soon, despite all the setbacks, triumph. Dr. Schmidt, who was present as interpreter, has recalled the scene. Mussolini was absolutely horrified. He could not understand how such a